Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Friday, the 23rd of March, and it is time for the wake-up call, coming to you from Singapore. And we are able, hopefully, to bring you news of the world from this part, and I fully intend to do so as things improve in the world, and I think they will improve in Asia. So hopefully I'm well placed to bring you some exciting news in, say, 4 or 5 years' time. Anyway, here we are today, towards the end of March, at a very grim period in world history. And as I was looking for ways in which to entertain you today, I noticed that the European new car market crashed in February. According to data released by the European Manufacturers Association, new car sales were down 9.7% in February. 2 months into the year, car sales in the European Union are down 8.3% from the same period a year earlier. This February, needless to say, was the worst of the new millennium. Only 888,878 units changed hands. The European Union basket cases, Greece and Portugal, saw their new car sales nearly halved. These are, of course, relatively unimportant markets. But by now, tiny Luxembourg has more car sales than Greece. If Greece did leave the European Union, it wouldn't even register in the car statistics. What hurts much more is the deterioration of the volume markets. France, down 20.2%. Italy, down 18.9%. Let's talk about America's car market for a few minutes. Americans have an illogical love affair with their vehicles. There are 209 million licensed drivers in the U.S., and 260 million vehicles. The U.S. has a higher number of motor vehicles per capita than every country in the world at 845 per 1,000 people. The population of the United States has increased by 108 million in 42 years. Over the same time frame, the number of motor vehicles on America's crumbling highways has grown by 150 million. This might explain why a country that has 4.5% of the world's population consumes 22% of the world's daily oil supply. Automobiles have been a vital component in the financial Ponzi scheme that has passed for an economic system over the last 30 years. For most of the last 30 years, annual vehicle sales have ranged between 15 and 20 million, with only occasional drops below that during recessions. They actually surged during the 2001-2002 recessions as Americans dutifully obeyed their moron president and bought millions of monster SUVs, Hummers, and Silverado pickups, with 0% financing from GM to defeat terrorism. Alan Greenspan provided the fuel with ridiculously low interest rates. The Madison Avenue media maggots provided the transmission fluid by convincing millions of willfully ignorant Americans to buy or lease vehicles they couldn't afford. And the financially clueless dupes pushed the pedal to the metal until everyone went off the cliff in 2008. The spiral of government-sponsored debt-financed debacles has shockingly accelerated as America has supposedly been experiencing an economic recovery for the last 2 years. The 2008 financial meltdown was the result of too much debt peddled to too many people who never had the means or intentions of repaying the debt. The Wall Street peddlers of debt didn't care if it got repaid because they had already packaged it, bribed Moody's and S&P to rate the toxic garbage as AAA, and sold it to their so-called clients. Then they made derivative bets that it wouldn't be repaid and raked in billions more as their Ponzi scheme unwound. There was just one problem with their master plan. The Wall Street titans made their derivative weapons of mass destruction so complicated and so confusing that their own evil organizations of Harvard MBAs didn't understand them. Enough hubristic CEOs existed as enough financial firms like AIG, Lehman, Bear Stearns, Citicorp to bring the entire system crashing down as the toxic derivatives intertwined every major institution in the worldwide banking cabal. What has happened since those dark days of 2008 is mind-blowing in its epic proportions of stupidity. It's absurd and ultimately suicidal to cure a debt disease by administering massive doses of more debt. But that's exactly what those in power have done. The national debt has risen by 61% in 3.5 years, while real GDP has grown by 1.9%. Not exactly what you might call a fabulous return on investment. There are 7 million fewer people employed today than at the peak in 2008. Plus, senior citizens and middle-class savers have seen $450 billion of annual interest income they were earning in 2008 pilfered from their savings accounts and handed over to the Wall Street banking elite through Ben Bernanke's zero interest rate policy. The Federal Reserve has tripled their balance sheet, actually your liability, to $2.9 trillion. Various other federal government-controlled bureaucracies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, have stealthily subsidized hundreds of billions in losses on behalf of the criminal Wall Street banks. Other federal government-run agencies exist solely to massage, manipulate, misuse, and malign economic data and financial projections in order to muddle, misinform, and mislead the American people about the true nature of the ongoing economic calamity. Propaganda and obfuscation are the scheme of choice by the powers that be. They are counting on decades of government-run public education to ensure that millions of non-critical thinking dullards will be unqualified or uninterested in the truth about the country's grim economic prospects. The oligarchy's master plan has centered on houses, automobiles, and the illusion of a jobs recovery. Total U.S. credit debt market has risen from $50.9 trillion in 2007 to $54.1 trillion as of the end of last year, a $3.2 trillion increase. Household debt has declined from $13.8 trillion in 2007 to $13.2 trillion as of the end of last year. The mainstream media would point to this $600 billion decline as proof that Americans have embraced austerity and have learned their lesson. Of course, that would be a lie. The Wall Street banks have written off $200 billion of credit card debt, and the 5 million completed foreclosures extinguished another $800 billion of mortgage debt. The truth, ladies and gentlemen, is that consumers have continued to pile up debt. Much has been made of corporate America being flush with cash. So, if they're so flush, why have they added $900 billion of debt since 2007, an increase of 13% to an all-time high of $7.8 trillion? The revealing data shows up in the financial company data. These Wall Street national treasures have reduced their debt from $17.1 trillion in 2008 to $13.6 trillion as of the 31st of December 2011. How were they able to do this while writing off $1 trillion of consumer debt? You guessed it. They dumped it on the American taxpayer. The federal government increased their debt from $5.1 trillion to $10.5 trillion. And our old friends called government-sponsored enterprises, yep, Fannie, Freddie, student loans, increased their debt from $2.9 trillion to $6.2 trillion. Wall Street banks and millions of deadbeats who chose to game the system and live the good life have effectively foisted their $4.5 trillion of debt upon the backs of middle-class taxpayers who lived within their means. Another $4.2 trillion has been pissed down the toilet by Obama with his $800 billion Keynesian pork programs, home buyer tax credits, cash for clunkers, green energy, boondoggles, 47 million people on food stamps, 99 weeks of unemployment, doubling of SSDI membership, and his multiple wars of choice in the Middle East. The average hard-working taxpaying American has been enslaved in debt of such proportions that they will never be able to pay it off. Your share of the $15.6 trillion national debt is now $50,000 per person and growing by $4,500 a year. Your share of the future unfunded liabilities created by the people you elected is approximately $350,000. This crushing burden is in addition to the $13.8 trillion of mortgage, credit card, student loan, and auto loan debt Americans have accumulated in the last three decades of delusion. 40% of all credit card users do not pay off their credit card every month and carry an average balance of $16,000 at an average interest rate of 15%. Good to see the Wall Street banks passing along some of their 0% borrowing windfall to their so-called customers. I don't think. You may have noticed the corporate mainstream media, crooked politicians and lying Wall Street shills attempting to pound the economic recovery storyline into the consciousness of a terminally distracted populace. Decades of mass media consumer indoctrination, dumbing down of children through public school education, and the conscious manipulation of attitudes and opinions of the malleable masses has succeeded. The invisible government of the rich and powerful has effectively converted responsible citizens into mindless consumers of products bought with debt, peddled by associates of the invisible government. The crowded shopping malls, automobile showrooms, and restaurants are a testament to the power of propaganda and the intellectual bankruptcy of a vast swath of the American population. The entire recovery theme is a sham, financed by the federal government with your tax dollars and the tax dollars of future unborn generations. The mantra being pounded relentlessly by the mainstream media is that retail sales are booming, the unemployment rate has declined significantly, therefore an economic recovery is at hand. The rapid surge in auto sales has also resulted in a boost to overall retail sales, which have reached an all-time high. Automobile so-called sales make up 18% of the retail sales number, by far the largest segment. The so-called record retail sales are the result of surging gasoline sales, swelling food inflation, and a somewhat confusing cascade of car sales. You will remain confused until you realize how and why the 50% rise in vehicle sales has been accomplished. Retail sales in the first 2 months of 2012 are up 8.2%, led by a 9.2% wave of motor vehicle sales. Auto sales are at levels last seen in early 2008. This does seem peculiar, doesn't it? Since there are still 7 million less unemployed people in the country than in early 2008, and the real median household income is 9% lower than it was in early 2008. Real average hourly earnings have fallen for the last 3 months and are 1.2% lower than they were in October 2010. A critical thinking person might ask himself, how could American households with fewer jobs and lower wages increase their purchases of automobiles by 50% in the last 2 years? The answer is just what you expected. A phenomenal amount of debt peddled to people without the means or intent of ever repaying the debt by the usual suspects. Ally Financial, Capital One, Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan, and Bank of America. These fine, upstanding institutions control 25% of the auto loan market. They doled out $24 billion of new car loans in the fourth quarter of 2011, with an outpouring of loans to those downtrodden subprime borrowers and an extension in the average loan length beyond 6 years. Subprime borrowers now account for 45% of all auto loans. I will repeat that, ladies and gentlemen, just in case you happen to be looking out of the window. Subprime borrowers, those very people responsible for the cascade of housing prices starting in 2006, those same subprime borrowers now account for almost half of all auto loans. You may remember from another unfortunate incident concerning the subprime borrowers, they generally have few or no assets. A history of late payments or defaulting on obligations and low incomes. No worries there. When has making hundreds of billions in subprime loans ever caused a problem before? Bank of America and Capital One increased their market shares of the auto loan market by 40% in the fourth quarter as they attempt to keep up with Ally Financial in reckless lending to deadbeats. Oh, by the way, if you aren't familiar with Ally Financial, then you should be. You own 74% of this disaster story. And just as a brief diversion here, a little bit of a summary. GMAC, after contributing mightily to the financial crash of 2008 through their reckless subprime mortgage, DITEC, and auto lending, and requiring a $16 billion bailout from American taxpayers, changed its name to Ally Financial in 2009. It's sort of like John Dillinger using acid to try and change his fingerprints. Ally Financial provides financing for all GM and Chrysler customers and dealers and is the market share leader in auto lending. Ally Financial still owes the American taxpayers $12 billion. Ally Financial is a ward of the federal government and will do anything it is told to do by Obama. The recent foreclosure fraud settlement required Ally to pay $250 million to the customers it defrauded. They will only pay $110 million based on their inability to pay $250 million. Yes, that sounds like a company that should be increasing their subprime loan portfolio, doesn't it? Ally Financial, along with Capital One, failed the Federal Reserve stress tests last week. Ally, Capital One, Bank of America, and Citicorp are dead banks walking. And the real lesson, ladies and gentlemen, is that the good old USA is a subprime nation, a society of individuals whose aggregate probability of default is probably around a B to triple C. When you understand this background, anecdotal evidence that seems absurd starts to make sense. The average household income in the Mantua section of West Philadelphia is $16,000. The average home value is $25,000. The true unemployment rate exceeds 40%. At least 20% of the properties are vacant, and the neighborhood resembles Baghdad. Every block has brand new Model Ford Expeditions, GMC Sierras, BMWs, Acuras, Cadillacs, and Mercedes sprinkled among the squalor. Someone is loaning these people the money to buy these 40,000 vehicles or approving them. This neighborhood puts the sub in subprime. No financial firm worth spit would make a six-year, $35,000 auto loan to someone in this neighborhood unless they were instructed to do so by the federal government or were guaranteed that the future loss would be borne by someone else. You! Look at the car ads in your local paper. They will say things like, have credit problems? No problem. Most of the ads don't even list the prices of the vehicles. They either tout the 72-month 0% financing, or they list the monthly lease cost. It seems that virtually any vehicle can be leased for $300 a month or less these days. So this might just explain why 25% of all vehicles are leased today. In reality, 25% of the cars being sold today are really just being rented for 3 years. Both the lessors and lessees are basing these transactions upon delusions and assumptions which will likely blow up in their faces and again cost you. An auto lease payment is based on interest rates, the cost of the car, subsidies from the automakers, and the expected residual value of the vehicle at the end of the three-year lease. When have financial companies ever miscalculated any of these assumptions? How about 2001, 2002, and 2008, 2009? Look, let's get real here. The reason auto leases are ridiculously low is because Ben Bernanke's zero interest rate policy is providing free money to Ally Financial and the rest of the Wall Street zombie banks and creating huge malinvestment again. The automakers see no risks, as the used car market has been extremely strong for the last year, and they anticipate continued strong demand for cars as they come off their three-year leases. Therefore, they have estimated the residual values 3 years out at a very high level. The strong used car market may have been slightly impacted by the destruction of 700,000 vehicles under Obama's Cash for Clunkers debacle. The combination of excessively low interest rates and excessively high residual value estimates leads to ridiculously low lease rates. The sales statistics for the first 2 months of 2012 reveal why this will blow up in the faces of lessors in the predictably incompetent financial drug dealers. It seems the delusional American public and their love affair with big SUVs, pickups, and their eight-cylinder luxury wheels will continue until they are hit over the head with a baseball bat of $5 a gallon gas. Madison Avenue has molded the minds and formed the opinions of millions of easily influenced, financially ignorant, superficial Americans into believing the vehicle they drive is a true measurement of success. These people choose being up to their eyeballs in auto debt or perennial renters of luxury vehicles to appear prosperous to their neighbors and co-workers rather than actually achieving real success through the time-honored tradition of earning more than you spend and saving the difference. The fact is, 80% of all the vehicles being sold in the U.S. are SUVs, pickups, crossovers, minivans, and larger cars that get 25 miles per gallon or less. As gas prices continue to rise towards $5 a gallon, interest rates beginning to rise, and the country headed back into recession, the car makers are poised to again experience enormous losses. Automakers will have a sense of deja vu as they have committed an epic blunder by overestimating the future value of the gas guzzlers they have been leasing. As a result, when the leases expire and automakers take back the SUVs and pickups that get 15 miles per gallon and attempt to resell them, the losses will run into the billions of dollars. There will be no one buying used gas guzzlers, with gas costing $5 a gallon. As the millions of subprime borrowers realize they can't afford card payments, paying 40% more for gas and trying to put food on the table, auto loan delinquencies will soar. Ladies and gentlemen, this is as predictable as the housing market collapse in 2005. None of this matters to the psychotic governing elite who only care about the illusion of recovery today. These vampire squids will not be satisfied until every drop of blood is sucked out of the national carcass. Ally Financial is part of the federal government and is being used to promote the agenda of the governing elite. They join Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the federal student loan peddlers as the primary tools of the corporate fascist powers that control your country. The nominal private ownership of these countries is a sham, as the state dictates how they will be run and who they will benefit. This corporate fascist empire is built upon an unholy alliance between big banks, big business, big media, and big government, with each protecting and enriching each other. The psychopaths who are drawn to these organizations want to control people. They desire power, wealth, and the ability to manipulate public opinion. Their tactics including spreading fear and an atmosphere of paranoia in order to convince the populace that more government action will improve their lives. Ladies and gentlemen, we are headed towards economic and financial collapse, as these psychopaths will never willingly reverse course, and the majority of the population has become so degraded. You've been to a Walmart lately? They are incapable or unwilling to confront the psychopaths. All right, let's take a break. I'll be right back. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back, and let me very quickly give you my information before we proceed. I'm Richard Martin, this is the wake-up call, and it's coming from Singapore, and it has, it comes complete with a toll-free number for your use. It's getting a little dusty, but nothing that a few excited people cannot cure. By using it, it is 888-874 4888. That's our toll-free number if you'd like to talk to me, ask questions, inform the current listenership of anything that's on your mind. You may do so. Once again, the number is 888-874-4888. If you want to send in your emails, which contain information, questions, comments, observations of one sort or another, please feel free to do so. My email address is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin. GFAWD stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. Once again, rm@gfawd.com. And as always, if you'd like to call me in private with your issues, concerns of one sort or another, please do so. I would be glad to help you out in whatever way I possibly can. And the number to call is an area code in Sarasota, Florida. You do not have to call Singapore. You can just stop your financial considerations in Sarasota by dialing area code 941-441-1682. Again, that's to call me, please leave a name and a phone number if you would like me to call you back. We are exactly 12 hours ahead of you in the East Coast, and so don't worry if I'm not here. You won't wake me up or anything. You will just be able to leave a message, and I will call you back. Again, the number is 941-441-1682. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we come to the moment of truth. Every month, the Richard Martin meetup group, which will meet as usual on Sunday, this coming Sunday, in 2 days, on the 25th, in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And the George Street Ale House is the venue, which has been used for several meetings and appears to be working very well. It is to be found at 378 George Street, 378 George Street in New Brunswick, New Jersey, a stone's throw from the railroad station, and of course there is parking, and our moderator would be glad to hear from you. Her name is Susan, and her number is 202-246-5131. She would like you to call and confirm your attendance, ladies and gentlemen. Her number is again 202-246-5131. I must tell you that everything I am reading, every single piece of information that comes my way appears to me as a kind of point of no return, in as much as it doesn't seem to be remediable. I can't emphasize this enough. Things are really reaching a point of distraction in the United States. Those of you who have any ideas, any possibility of leaving, should go to this meetup group, because you will be given interesting information. I believe Susan actually has somebody coming to make a presentation on Sunday. You can get more details from her. But everything that I come to you with tells me that we are reaching a point of inflection socially, economically, financially, which will never be redressed, ever. I think that we are looking at decades of dark ages here, and I must tell you that the United States is the worst country to be in, if I am correct about this. And even if I'm not correct, the United States is going to be a very grim country to live in for the next half century at least. And there are plenty of countries that will welcome you with open arms, but you're going to have to move fast, because many people now are doing this. They are moving, they are making arrangements to leave, and believe me, ladies and gentlemen, if you listen to the wake-up call much longer, you will be infused with more reasons than you can even remember for wanting to leave the country. And I know I am unique in saying this. I know that there are people who talk and say how bad things are, and I'm receiving emails from people who talk about how bad things are, but they always, always, always stop short of recommending that you leave. And once again, I will remind you that there are people, or there were people, who left their own countries in times past to come and live in the United States and create that country. You are now in the situation of those people who left their countries. You are no longer in the situation of people able economically to invite people to come and live in your country, which is why you are having problems with immigration from other countries. But you need to take responsibility for yourselves now as people who need to take up the cudgel and do something about it, because it's not going to get better. So please call Susan, go and listen to what's being talked about. There will be many people who have been there before. They will welcome you with open arms. They will talk about their own experiences. Once again, Susan's number is 202-246-5131. Well, this last weekend, I sent out to my email distribution group an article dealing with why the so-called American empire was destined to collapse. And I got an interesting response from Andy Celsius as follows. Thanks. Good read. After reading Dr. Berman's bio, I'm perplexed as to whether he thinks it's safer to live in the largest Mexican city, located at the base of a volcano with a history of large earthquakes, than it will be to live in the U.S. in the last quarter of his life. Anyway. Also, I have started to take issue with the meme that Rome collapsed. Isn't it a bit of a misnomer? It was a 400-year decline with a whimper and a sneeze. Nothing dramatic. No declarations. Nothing to see here, folks. Keep working. 2012 update. Shopping. Very, very hard not to be frozen by all the data and influences of all the interpretations of the data. In the end, we have to be awakened to our present reality, our personal reality, and make choices about where, what, how, and with whom best as we can, with the information we have about the world inside and out. As the Hindus say, when you awaken to yours and I awaken to mine, we are awake. Well, there we go, ladies and gentlemen. It's an interesting somewhat association with what we talk about, and thank you, Andy, for your contribution. I just got an email from Kevin Moran, who says, this tax here, Kevin, by the way, is a CPA, so he knows about tax preparation time, which he says, this tax preparation season, once again, we are seeing credit card write-off settlements ranging from $2,000 to as much as $20,000. This seems to be continuing year after year. These taxpayers have to recognize this as income on their personal tax returns. Kevin. Well, thank you, Kevin. Appreciate it. All right. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit now about the stock market. I don't do that very often, but I've been receiving a flood of questions about whether the economic recovery really is for real. Everybody's screaming about it. Everybody's congratulating everybody else. Ben Bernanke appearing as a hero on the front page of the Atlantic magazine this month. I mean, it's deafening. And so I felt that some sort of rebuttal was called for, especially when it comes to the stock market, because this is really the place where you see the ultimate expression of people's views about the so-called economic recovery. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have mentioned over and over and over again, there is no real economic recovery. So actually, I won't go over that again here, but clearly the optimism in that regard has had a profound effect. You know, starting in 1998, when the market traded at extreme levels, it has never since then traded at levels that could be considered cheap or even inexpensive. after trading at extremely high valuation levels at the peak in 2000. So essentially, the stock market has not been considered inexpensive for the past 14 years. And you could most definitely expect the stock market to trade at typical bear market trough valuations, which are like 7 to 10 PE ratios, or even at or better than 5 in extreme cases. And that's after two major bull market scams, the dot-com and the housing rises. You know, after the bubble broke in 2000, the S&P 500 dropped to about 70 in 2002, and that's when the Fed, which was at that time led by Alan Greenspan, lowered interest rates to 1% from 6.5% in 2000. And as you know, they'd been kept there for forever, and this started the housing bubble from 2002 to 2000, bankers packaging mortgages and selling them to their clients. And as you know, this was accompanied by another bubble in the stock market. And can you imagine going into another stock market bubble less than 3 years from the most outrageous bubble of all time? The government got involved in fiscal stimulus, housing price supports, easy money, bailouts, which drove the market yet higher. And now that this market has doubled again, I can expect the decline by half again, at least, and in fact a lot more after the technical damage of the 2009 break to new lows, which is below the 800 trough of 2002. The sentiment measured by Ned Davis research of crowd pessimism and optimism backs up the peaks and troughs we have been discussing. Periods of time where there is excess optimism are very negative for stocks. And the periods where there is a lack of optimism are very positive for stocks. At the peak in 2000 of 1550 in the S&P, the optimism was over 66.8. And that's what we call extreme optimism, which is above 61.5%. At the peak in 2007, which was at 1570 in the S&P, it was at 69.2%. And right now, at 1405, which we saw recently, we are at 68.2%. So if that doesn't tell you that we're sitting at or near a stock market top, I don't know what does. Well, as usual, ladies and gentlemen, the debt always jumps out to me as a major problem. I can't imagine the U.S. will be able to escape the problems of the total debt load it has accumulated over the past 30 years. Whenever debt is mentioned, almost everyone focuses in on the government debt relative to GDP. I, on the other hand, prefer to look at and analyze total debt, including private debt and the government unfunded liabilities. And if you take total debt, when you have an aging demographic, and where there were promises made that cannot be kept, you will be faced with an insolvable debt problem. This brings us to the problem of the promises made in healthcare, where the total amount of money spent for healthcare in the U.S. per capita is at least double every other country's, and the medical outcomes are basically the same. In fact, the country should clearly be paying for outcomes and not procedures. The total debt has grown to over $110 trillion, which will be very difficult to accommodate since this equates to a debt-to-GDP ratio of over 700%. The unemployment rate is said to have declined to 8.3%, but at least half the decline is explained by many older citizens who have dropped out of the labor force, as men, as well as many other discouraged workers dropping out. And the U.S. continues to generate jobs at the same rate as the past couple of years, and it would take 13 years to get to full employment. Keep in mind that there are fewer jobs presently than there were 11 years ago. Housing is dependent upon a vigorous jobs market, and with all the debt the household sector has built up, I don't expect the housing market to bottom before the prices decline to at least the trend line of nominal prices taking out the bubble prices of housing from 2002 to 2007, and we still have 10 to 15% more decline left. And that doesn't allow for any of the overshoot always associated with strongly moving markets in either direction. The National Association of Home Builders February Confidence Index was just released at 28, unchanged from January. And keep in mind that anything under 50 is considered negative. We're also looking at what Ben Bernanke called a fiscal cliff. He was referring to the Bush tax cuts expiring at the end of the year. And if they expire on everyone, it will essentially be a tax increase of about $450 billion a year, or $4.5 trillion over 10 years. The payroll tax holiday expires, and that could be another $100 billion a year, and the super committee will be forced to sequester another $100 billion of spending. Also, their winding down of the $787 billion fiscal stimulus package that was initiated in 2009. This will turn out to be as crushing a burden to the United States as the austerity programs imposed on Greece and other European countries more recently. Europe, Japan, China are all struggling now. We know about Europe's dire problems. Japan hasn't been able to extricate themselves from the deleveraging of the debt built up during the 1980s until their debt build-up burst in late 1989, which, by the way, is similar to the U.S. in 2000 and again in 2008. China's growth rate has been slowing since 2009 as the government has been attempting to slow the economy gradually due to inflation worries. However, the housing market has declined for the last 5 months, and the government may find that it's very difficult to fine-tune a decline, especially since it has spent 50% of the GDP to build infrastructure, housing, and office buildings, many of them, of course, now empty or struggling. HSBC Bank rates China's growth this year will at around 8%, which is the slowest in a decade. Now, ladies and gentlemen, how do you possibly think that the U.S. stock market or even the U.S. economy can continue as a recovery and an up move against all these odds with the entire world moving into recession and depression? It's impossible. It cannot happen, ladies and gentlemen. The U.S. cannot progress with the world moving into the ultimate stages of recession and depression. It's not going to happen. Well, did you know that feeding the homeless has been banned in major cities all over America? Other cities that haven't banned it outright have put so many requirements on those who want to feed the homeless, such as acquiring expensive permits, taking food preparation courses, etc., that feeding the homeless has become out of reach for most people. It isn't as if the government has rescued these homeless people. Homeless shelters all over the nation are turning people away each night because they have no more room. There are many homeless people that are lucky just to make it through each night alive during the winter. Mayor Nutter, interesting name. Mayor Nutter recently banned feeding homeless people in many parts of Philadelphia where homeless people are known to congregate. Last June, a group of activists in Orlando, Florida were arrested by police for feeding the homeless in defiance of a city ordinance. In Houston, a group of Christians was recently banned from distributing food to the homeless. A Dallas area ministry is suing the city over a food ordinance that restricts the group from giving meals to the homeless. A few years ago, Las Vegas became the first major U.S. city to specifically pass a law banning the feeding of homeless people. New York City has banned all food donations to government-run homeless shelters because the bureaucrats there are concerned that the donated food will not be nutritious enough. A church in Louisiana was recently ordered to stop giving out water because it didn't have a government permit. Yet another powerful reason for wanting to move out of America, ladies and gentlemen, and this, by the way, is a reason which I've never even mentioned in a single wake-up call before. The list just grows and grows, doesn't it? Once again, let me remind you of Susan's phone number, 202-246-5131. Well, let us take a few more emails, if I can find them. There are a little pile of them around here a while back. Seem to have lost them. Oh well, not to worry. Consider this headline from CNBC. Early spring boosts economy, but benefit may not last. Some economists warn that the pull-forward demand from the unusually warm weather will wear off and the U.S. economy will soon be back in a chilly, slow-growth mode. Richard, this guy bases his recovery idea on a recovering housing market and warm weather. Imagine that, warm weather as an economic indicator. Any truth in that idea would cause Haiti to be one of the most prosperous nations on earth. Wishful thinking. Well, ladies and gentlemen, no prizes for guessing who that email came from. Oh, yes, the one and only Steve Kruger. And then he continues with another email. As an aside, I just checked out Realtor.com, and the house next to the one we sold in 2007 is for sale, and they are asking over $100,000 less. Thank you, RM. And that, of course, also came from Steve Kruger. Well, I came across this just yesterday. Absolute Strategy Research, ASR, a well-known London advisory firm, just came out with a survey about the American economy and had this to say. A staggering 63% of respondents across the political spectrum feel that the American economic model is broken and no longer works for most Americans. Just 36% of respondents believe the American model facilitates equal opportunity, while 58% disagree. Individual surveys do not agree that the prevailing paradigm facilitates equal opportunity or that hard work and skill are rewarded. Respondents across the political spectrum agree that policymakers have not done a good job in handling the economy. Only the 55 to 65-year-olds seem to anticipate that they may have to work longer than they expected 2 to 3 years ago. Their younger counterparts are far more sanguine and still expect to retire earlier than their parents. More than 40% of those polled believe that the children of their generation will have a lower standard of living when they are their age. 20% of those polled continue to expect house prices to carry on falling. A third of homeowners or home buyers are sitting on an unrealized capital loss, while a quarter believe their house is worth less than their mortgage. Perhaps the most surprising aspect of the study was in response to the question described as, quote, thinking about the upcoming presidential election, which three of the following economic issues do you think should be the top priorities for the next administration? Despite 26% of the respondents being underwater on their mortgage, only 15% felt that a top priority should be given to improving mortgage availability and reviving the housing market. Only 15% felt that government should reduce spending. Well, if you want more information, just Google Absolute Strategy Research. That's the name of the advisory firm that came out with this. Again, the name is to Google Absolute Strategy Research. It should give you some interesting information over and above what I have had to to offer you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this has been a good and interesting show that I have enjoyed bringing to you. I actually am conflicted about whether I am, whether I do enjoy bringing these things to you, or whether actually I feel sorry about having to do so. But I do think that I am privileged to have this forum to be able to bring you information which, quite frankly, is totally unavailable in the mainstream media. And I'm sure you would agree with me. I'm sure you would agree that, quite frankly, you will not find 90% of what I tell you in the mainstream media. So I am glad to bring this to you. So let's see what I have here. One more thing. The White House said on Sunday that it's withholding some $800 million in military aid to Pakistan. The $800 million is about a third of the annual U.S. security aid to Pakistan. Diplomatic observers in Washington say that while the U.S. cut will hurt Pakistan, it's unlikely to persuade the Pakistani military to follow Washington's instructions. And on Sunday, the Pentagon sent a statement to some U.S. news outlets noting that the U.S., or rather the Pakistani military, also had requested a significant cutback of U.S. military trainers. On Sunday, White House Chief of Staff Bill Daley told ABC television that Pakistan had, quote, taken some steps that had given us reason to pause on some of the aid which we're giving to the military, end of quote. Well, when Barack Obama came to power, he said he would bring Pakistan to the table with more aid. So this is just another example of where, quite frankly, aid to the United States means nothing more nor nothing less than bringing bribes to other countries to do its bidding. And I think you're going to find that that works less and less. So anyway, ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of another wake-up call. Many of you will feel constrained to go to New Brunswick on Sunday. And until Monday, let me wish you all a wonderful weekend. Take care. Until then, this is Richard Martin wishing you a great time ahead. Take care. Bye-bye.